Welcome to Program Notes for your North Carolina Symphony, an exclusive production of the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm George Douglas. I'll be reading the program notes for all of the Classical Music Series concerts by the North Carolina Symphony for the remainder of the 2019 season. The program notes I'm reading today are for the performance by the North Carolina Symphony at 8 p.m. Friday and Saturday, January 25th and 26th, at Maymandy Concert Hall, Duke Energy Center for the Performing Arts in Raleigh, and at 7:30 p.m. Sunday, January 27th at Memorial Hall, UNC Chapel Hill. Now, this concert is conducted by Grant Llewellyn with a featured soloist, violinist Augustine Hodelik. The program on this performance will include the following. The symphony comes on the stage to perform Valse Triste, Opus 44, Number 1, by Jean Sibelius. And that will be followed by another Sibelius work, the Violin Concerto in D Minor, Opus 47, and that will feature our guest violinist, Augustine Hodelik. Then, following the intermission, the symphony returns to the stage to play the suite from Pulcinella, the 1949 revision by Igor Stravinsky, and that will be followed by another Stravinsky composition, the suite from The Firebird, the 1919 revision. Now I'll begin our reading of symphony notes. I'll begin with some background information on our featured soloist, named 2018 Instrumentalist of the Year by Musical America at the age of 34. Augustine Hodelik has performed with every major orchestra in the U.S., many on numerous occasions, as well as an ever-growing number of orchestras in Europe and Asia. International highlights of the 2018-19 season include his debut with the Bavarian Radio Orchestra, Munich, and engagements with Belgian National Orchestra, Danish National Symphony, Finnish Radio Symphony, Hong Kong Philharmonic, the Orchestra Nationale de Lyon, Orchestra Nationale de España, and the Symphony Orchestras of Bournemouth, New Zealand, Sao Paulo, and Singapore. A tense concert tour of Germany with the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields features double concertos with violinist Julia Fischer. In the United States, he will return to the symphonies of Cincinnati, Dallas, Indianapolis, Minnesota, New Jersey, North Carolina, San Diego, and Seattle, as well as the Los Angeles Philharmonic at the Hollywood Bowl. At his most recent concerts with the North Carolina Symphony in 2017, he performed Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto in Raleigh and in Southern Pines. Summer 2018 saw Augustine Hodelik's debut at the Salzburger Festival, performing the Sibelius Violin Concerto with the ORF Vienna Radio Symphony, as well as return appearances at the Aspen, Bravo, Vail, and Colorado music festivals. Other recent festival appearances include his debut at the BBC Proms, as well as performances with the Boston Symphony Orchestra at Tanglewood and the Cleveland Orchestra at Blossom. Augustine Hodelik is a winner of a 2016 Grammy Award, Best Classical Instrumental Solo, for his recording of Dutilleux's violin concerto L'Arbre des Songs with the Seattle Symphony. Hodelik's January 2018 release features Paganini's 24 Caprice. Other recent discs include live recordings of violin concertos by Tchaikovsky and Lalo, the Symphony Espagnole, with the London Philharmonic Orchestra. That was in 2017. The Mendelssohn Violin Concerto and Bartók's Violin Concerto No. 2 with the Norwegian Radio Orchestra under Miguel Harth Bedoya in 2015, and the violin concertos of Jean Sibelius and Thomas Addis, Concentric Paths, with the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra in 2014, nominated for a Gramophone Award and listed by NPR on their top 10 classical CDs of 2014. Hodelik's career took off when he won the gold medal at the 2006 International Violin Competition of Indianapolis. Since then, his honors include an Avery Fisher Career Grant in 2009, a Borletti Buitoni Trust Fellowship in the UK in 2011, Lincoln Center's Martin E. Segal Award in 2012, the inaugural Warner Music Prize 2015, a Grammy Award 2016, and an honorary doctorate from the University of Exeter in the UK in 2017. Born in Italy, the son of German parents, Hodulik is now an American citizen. He holds an artist diploma from the Juilliard School. Hodulik plays the 1723 ex Kiesewetter Stradivari violin on loan from Clement and Karen Arison through the Stradivari Society of Chicago. This North Carolina Symphony program begins with Valse Triste, Opus 44, No. 1 by Jean Sibelius. Sibelius was born December 8, 1865, in Hämeenlinna, Finland, and he died September 20, 1957, in Järvenpää, Finland. It was composed in 1903, and the first performance was December 2, 1903, in Helsinki, conducted by the composer. Now, here is the overview. Though Sibelius is universally recognized as the Finnish master of the symphony, tone poem, and concerto, he also produced a large amount of music in the more intimate forms, including the scores for 11 plays. The music to accompany a 1926 production of Shakespeare's The Tempest was his last orchestral work. Early in 1903, Sibelius composed the music to underscore six scenes of a play by his brother-in-law, Arvid Jarnefelt, titled Kuolema. Among the music was a piece accompanying the scene in which Pavali, the central character, is seen at the bedside of his dying mother. She tells him that she has dreamed of attending a ball. Pavali falls asleep and death enters to claim his victim. The mother mistakes death for her deceased husband and dances away with him. Pavali awakes to find her dead. Sibelius gave little importance to this slight work, telling a biographer that, with all retouching, it was finished in a week. 2 years later, he arranged the music for solo piano and for chamber orchestra as Valse Triste, which means sad waltz, and sold it outright to his publisher, Fazer and Westerlund, for a tiny fee. The piece became immediately popular at a Salon Bonbon when the German firm Breitkopf and Hartel acquired the rights to Sibelius' music from Fazer and Westerlund late in 1905. They issued it in arrangements for all manner of performing forces, from solo flute to military band. Well, the Valse Triste was the music by which Sibelius first became known in America. Rachmaninoff had experienced a similar instant notoriety because of his little prelude in C-sharp minor a decade earlier. And he conducted it on his first concert in the United States at the Norfolk, Connecticut Music Festival on June 4, 1914. It was among the most ubiquitous melodies in the years just before World War I. But Sibelius, having sold away his rights, shared in none of the royalties. Now here's what to listen for. Sibelius, like Brahms and Richard Strauss, was a great admirer of the waltzes of Johann Strauss. Sibelius' biographer, Cecil Gray, claimed that he once spent an evening in a café with the composer and was surprised at the constant stream of Viennese waltzes dispensed by the establishment's orchestra. When he asked his companion why they were playing in the staid old style rather than in the more fashionable jazz idiom, Sibelius smiled and said, "That is because I am here. They play it because they know I love it." Gray saw the Valse Triste as an homage à Strauss, and its success prompted Sibelius to add a Valse Romantique to the incidental music for a 1911 revival of Kuolema. Like the Viennese examples on which it is modeled, the Valse Triste comprises several continuous sections. It was the melancholy opening that suggested the work's name. This quiet, introspective paragraph is followed by a gossamer strain played with the utmost delicacy at the very tips of the string bows, a lyrical episode led by woodwinds and a more vigorous section for the full ensemble before the wistful mood of the opening returns briefly to round out this lovely, haunting miniature. The instrumentation for this work is as follows: flute, clarinet, two horns, timpani, and strings. Next, the North Carolina Symphony performs the Violin Concerto in D minor, Opus 47, also by John Sibelius. This work was composed in 1903. The first performance was February 8, 1904, in Helsinki, conducted by the composer with Viktor Novacek as the soloist. Now, here is the overview. The most famous image of Sibelius is the one seen in the photographic portraits of him in his old age. A stern, determined face, unsoftened by a single lock of hair. A thick, strong body conditioned by years of healthy living in the bracing Finnish air. The aura of a man occupied by the highest level of contemplation, hardly disturbed by the vicissitudes of daily life. This picture of Sibelius may be partly correct for his last years. He produced no new music for 30 years before his death and withdrew into the solitude of the Finnish forests. So reports were few, but it is very misleading for the time in which the violin concerto was produced. By 1903, when he was engaged on the concerto, Sibelius had already composed Finlandia, Kullervo and Saga, the Karelia Suite, the four Lemminkainen legends, including the Swan of Tuonela, and the first two symphonies, the works that established his international reputation. He was composing so easily at that time that his wife, Aino, wrote to a friend that he would stay up far into the night to record the flood of excellent ideas that had come upon him during the day. There were, however, some disturbing personal worries threatening his musical fecundity. In March 1902, just after the premiere of his Symphony No. 2, Sibelius developed a painful ear infection. Thoughts of the deafness of Beethoven and Smetana plagued him, and he feared he might be losing his hearing. He was only 37 at the time. In June, he began having trouble with his throat, and he feared that his health was about to give way. But he nevertheless forged ahead with his violin concerto. The ailments continued to plague him until 1908, when a benign tumor was discovered. It took a dozen operations until it was successfully removed, but anxiety about its return stayed with him for years. Sibelius, incidentally, enjoyed sterling health for the rest of his days, and he lived to the ripe old age of 91. Aggravating Sibelius' worries about his health in 1903 was the constant financial distress in which he was mired. His family was growing, and his works did not bring in enough to support them in the lifestyle that he desired. He was always in debt and wrote frequently to his brother, a physician in Germany, about the difficulty of making a decent living as a serious composer. For relaxation, Sibelius liked to frequent the local drinking establishments in Helsinki, and his generous and uncomplaining wife often found him unaccounted for after a day or two. Only once did she go to find him. That was when the finale of this concerto had to be finished so the parts could be copied in time for the performance. She set out with Robert Kajanish, conductor, staunch advocate of Sibelius' music, and friend of the family, and found Jean in one of his numerous haunts. The move to the country house at Jorvenpa, more than 20 miles north of Helsinki, was prompted in large part by the need to provide Sibelius with a quiet place, free from the distractions of city life. During those years of intense creative activity, Sibelius was a long way from that granitic old man of later years. Now here's what to listen for. The Violin Concerto's opening movement employs sonata form, though Sibelius endeavored to balance the soloistic display with the symphonic integration of violin and orchestra. This was the main purpose of the 1905 revision. He was himself a highly skilled violinist who abandoned thoughts of a soloist career only with the greatest reluctance. And the concerto's characteristic, if difficult, writing for the solo instrument shows his experience as a performer. Of the spirit of this work, Eric Tabasterna, the composer's biographer, wrote, "The concerto is distinctly Nordic in its overwhelming sense of nostalgia. The orchestra does not wallow in rich colors, but in the sonorous half-lights of autumn and winter. Only on rare occasions does the horizon brighten and glow." The opening movement employs sonata form, modified in that a succinct cadenza for the soloist replaces the usual development section. The exposition consists of three theme groups: a doleful melody announced by the soloist over murmuring strings, a yearning theme initiated by bassoons and cellos with rich accompaniment and a bold, propulsive strophe in march rhythm. The development cadenza is built on the opening motif and leads directly into the recapitulation of the exposition themes, here considered altered from their initial appearances. A coda, filled with flashing figurations for the soloist, closes the movement. The second movement could well be called a romanza, a descendant of the long-limbed lyricism of the andantes of the violin concertos of Mozart. It is among the most avowedly romantic music in any of Sibelius's work for orchestra. The sonatina form finale launches into a robust dance whose theme the esteemed English musicologist Sir Donald Tovey thought could be a polonaise for polar bears. The soloist's part accumulates difficulties as it goes, leading to an abrupt but resounding close. The instrumentation for this work is as follows: solo violin, two flutes, two oboes, two clarinets, two bassoons, four horns, two trumpets, three trombones, timpani, and strings. Following the intermission, the North Carolina Symphony returns to the stage to perform the Suite from Pulcinella by Igor Stravinsky. Stravinsky was born June 17, 1882, in Oranienbaum, near St. Petersburg, Russia, and he died April 6, 1971, in New York City. This work was composed in 1919 and 1920, revised in 1949, and the first performance was May 15, 1920, in Paris. Ernest Annersmet was the conductor. Now, here is the overview. The appearance of Stravinsky's Pulcinella in 1920 caused some consternation among the critics and the public of Paris. The musical work had just recovered from the seismic shock of Le Sacre du Printemps, the Rite of Spring, of 1913, the work that caused the most tempestuous opening night riot in the annals of music. During the intervening years, Stravinsky had come to be viewed not so much as a wild-eyed anarchist as a highly individual aberration of the great and continuing tradition of Russian Romantic music. He employed folk-like themes. He orchestrated in the grand manner of Tchaikovsky and Rimsky-Korsakov, and he wrote sharply etched rhythms that galvanized the corps de ballet, even if they played havoc with the toe-tapping proclivities of the patrons. The musical community allowed that by 1920 they knew Stravinsky well enough to be able to predict the future of his career. They were wrong. Stravinsky, though not uninterested in public opinion, was certainly not one to allow it to dictate the course of his music. He realized that Le Sacre had carried the techniques of the traditional Russian style about as far as they could go, and his artistic sense impelled him to strike out in new directions. During the First World War, when the logistical problems of assembling a large symphony orchestra were frequently insurmountable, he started to compose for small chamber ensembles. Les Noces, The Soldier's Tale, and the Ragtime for 11 Instruments date from that time. Those works were not well known in Paris, however, and when Pulcinella appeared, there was general surprise at what many perceived to be a stylistic about-face by Stravinsky. Gone were the massive orchestras of the early ballets, the hectic rhythmic patterns, the riveting dissonances. In their place, Stravinsky offered a ballet scored for small orchestra with three solo voices whose melodies, sonority, and ethos were built on the Baroque models of Giovanni Battista Pergolesi, a musical meteor who flashed briefly across the Italian artistic firmament during the early years of the 18th century and created several important instrumental and operatic pieces that laid the foundations of the classical style. Once the novelty had passed from Pulcinella, however, the public was delighted with the new piece, and Stravinsky reaped much approval for lighting out on a different path, one carefully attuned to the time. The ballet became a success, and its style led the way to a new attitude about the relationship between 20th century music and that of earlier eras, a trend that became known as neoclassicism. The idea for Pulcinella originated with Sergei Diaghilev, the legendary impresario of the Ballet Russe, who had also engaged Leonid Massine to choreograph the piece and devise the scenario and an appropriate text for the three vocal soloists, and Pablo Picasso to do the decor and the costumes. For the work's musical substance, Diaghilev suggested the music of Pergolesi to Stravinsky. The composer, perhaps with Diaghilev's help, Stravinsky's writings are unclear on this matter, selected from Pergolesi's works several movements from the trio sonatas and arias from two operas. To these he added a generous gaggle of musical bits by other composers. In general, he kept the bass lines and melodies of his models intact, but added to them his own spicy harmonies and invigorating rhythmic fillips, and then illuminated the whole piece with a brilliant, translucent orchestration. Stravinsky's role in Pulcinella, however, was far more than that of simply a transcriber or arranger. He not only created a cogent work of art from a wide variety of previously unrelated pieces, but he also gave a new perspective to both his own and Pergolesi's music. Pulcinella, he recalled in Dialogues and a Diary, was my discovery of the past, but it was a look in the mirror, too. With this music, Stravinsky found a manner in which to apply earlier styles and techniques to his own compositional needs, a discovery that was to provide the inspiration for his work for the next 30 years. Art About Art is American composer and critic Eric Salzman's perfect phrase describing the essence of Stravinsky's neoclassical aesthetic during the ensuing three decades. The plot of Stravinsky's ballet Pulcinella was based on an 18th-century manuscript of Commedia dell'arte, plays discovered in Naples. The composer provided the following synopsis. All the local girls are in love with Pulcinella, but the young men to whom they are betrothed are mad with jealousy and plot to kill him. The minute they think they have succeeded, they borrow costumes resembling Pulcinella's to present themselves to their sweethearts in disguise. But Pulcinella, cunning fellow, has already changed places with a double who pretends to succumb to their blows. The real Pulcinella, disguised as a magician, now resuscitates his double. At the very moment when the young men, thinking they are rid of their rival, come to claim their sweethearts, Pulcinella appears and arranges all the marriages. He himself weds Pimpinella, receiving the blessing of his double, who in his turn has assumed the magician's mantle. Now here's what to listen for. The movements of the suite serve as a precis of the ballet's music and story. The exuberant sinfonia, the overture, is based on the opening movement of Pergolesi's Trio Sonata No. 1 in G major. The movements that follow accompany the entrances of the Neapolitan girls who try to attract Pulcinella's attention with their dances. The serenata derives from a pastoral in Act 1 of Pergolesi's opera Flaminio. The scherzino is borrowed from a sonata by the Venetian violinist and composer Domenico Gallo. And the tarantella from the fourth movement of Fortunata Cellari's Concertina No. 6 in B-flat major portrays the confusion when Pulcinella is apparently restored to life. The movements that close the suite accompany the events from the point when the young men claim their sweethearts until the end of the ballet. The toccata and gavotta, con due variazioni, are based on anonymous harpsichord pieces. The vivo on Pergolesi's cello sonata in F major, the menuetto on a canzone from his comic opera Lo Frate Namorato, and the finale on a trio sonata by Gallo. The instrumentation for this work is as follows. It's for piccolo, two flutes, two bassoons, two horns, trumpet, trombone, tuba, and strings. And the final presentation from the North Carolina Symphony on this concert program is The Suite from the Firebird, also by Igor Stravinsky. This work was composed in 1909 and 1910, revised in 1919, and the first performance was June 25th in 1910 in Paris. Gabriel Pierney was the conductor. Now here is the overview. Fireworks. There could not have been a more appropriate title for the work that launched this meteoric career of Igor Stravinsky. He wrote that glittering orchestral miniature in 1908 while still under the tutelage of Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, and it shows all the dazzling instrumental technique that the student had acquired from his teacher. Though the reception of Fireworks was cool when it was first performed at the Salati Concerts in St. Petersburg on February 6, 1909, there was one member of the audience who listened with heightened interest. Sergei Diaghilev was forming his Ballet Russe company at just that time, and he recognized in Stravinsky a talent to be watched. He approached the 27-year-old composer and requested orchestral transcriptions of short pieces by Chopin and Grieg that would be used in the first Parisian season of the Ballet Russe. Stravinsky did his work well and on time. During that same winter, plans were beginning to stir in the creative wing of the Ballet Russe for a Russian folk ballet. Something filled with legend and magic and fantasy. The composer Nikolai Cherchpin was then associated with the Ballet Russe, and it was assumed he would compose the music for a plot derived from several traditional Russian sources. However, Cherchpin was given to inexplicable changes of mood, and he was losing interest in ballet at the time, so he withdrew from the project. Diaghilev then wrote to his old harmony professor, Anatoly Liadov, and asked him to consider taking on the task, informing him that the date for the premiere of the new work was firmly set for less than a year away. After too many weeks with no word from the dilatory composer, Diaghilev paid him a visit and was greeted with Liadov's report on his progress. "It won't be long now," Diaghilev was told. "It's well on its way. I have just today bought the manuscript paper." Well, realizing that the Firebird would never get off the ground at such a rate, Diaghilev inquired whether Stravinsky had any interest in taking over for Liadov. Though involved in another project, he had just completed the first act of the opera Nightingale, He was eager to work with the wonderful talent that had assembled under Diaghilev's banner, and he agreed after some delicate negotiations with Liadov. Stravinsky was officially awarded the commission in December, though his eagerness was so great that he had begun composing the music a month earlier. It is well that Stravinsky had a head start, because he had less than 6 months to complete the score. In his chronicles, he wrote, "Although alarmed by the fact that this was a commission with a fixed date, and afraid that I should fail to complete the work in time, I was still unaware of my own capabilities. I accepted the order. It was highly flattering to me to be chosen from among musicians of my generation and to be allowed to collaborate in so important an enterprise side by side with personages who were generally recognized as masters in their own spheres." It soon became clear that Stravinsky belonged to that company of masters. During one rehearsal, Diaghilev whispered into the ear of the prima ballerina Tamara Karsavina, "Mark him well. He is a man on the eve of celebrity." Diaghilev was as good a prophet as an impresario. The Firebird, which Stravinsky regarded as his first mature composition, was a stunning success at its premiere. With this score and the epochal Petrushka of the following year, in the Rite of Spring of 1913, Stravinsky went in just 5 short years from an obscure student composer in Russia to one of the most famous musicians in the world. With somewhat uncharacteristic understatement, he said, "The Firebird radically altered my life." Now here's what to listen for. The story deals with the glittering Firebird and the evil ogre Katshay, who captures maidens and turns men to stone if they enter his domain. Katshay is immortal as long as his soul, which is preserved in the form of an egg in a casket, remains intact. The plot shows how Prince Ivan wanders into Katshay's garden in pursuit of the Firebird. He captures it and exacts a feather before letting it go. Ivan meets a group of Katshay's captive maidens and falls in love with one of them. The princesses return to Katshay's palace. Ivan breaks open the gates to follow them, but he is captured by the ogre's guardian monsters. He waves the magic feather and the Firebird reappears to smash Katshay's vital egg. The ogre expires. All the captives are freed, and Ivan and his Shaverna are wed. Stravinsky drew 3 concert suites from the Firebird. The 1919 suite includes 6 scenes from the complete score. The first 2, Introduction and the Dance of the Firebird, accompany the appearance of the magical creature. The introduction includes 2 important musical motifs, the lugubrious low strings and trombones depicting the sinister atmosphere of Katshay's court in a winding melody outlining tritones, and the fluttering chirps of the Firebird portrayed by snapping woodwind figures. The brilliant dance that follows without interruption is characterized by quivering trills and scintillating little rockets of tone color exploding in every section of the orchestra. The dance of the princesses uses the rhythm and style of an ancient Russian dance called the khorovod. Its simple, plaintive theme is delicately scored to accompany the entrance of the maidens, while the hero looks on enraptured from the cover of a bush. The infernal dance of King Katshay is the most modern portion of the score. Its feverish, rhythmic energy, tritone-based themes, daring instrumental procedures, and thunderclap ferocity all look forward to the Rite of Spring. This is the music depicting the madness engendered by the appearance of the Firebird at Katshay's court after the revelation to Ivan of the evil ogre's vulnerability. The haunting Berceus is heard when the 13th princess, the one of whom Ivan is enamored, succumbs to a sleep charm which saves her from the terrible king, while Ivan destroys Katshay's malevolent power. The bassoon begins the dolorous strain and passes it to the oboe before it is caught up in the muted strings. The berceuse is connected to the finale by one of the most wondrous passages in all of Stravinsky's works. Tremolo strings give out a series of glistening harmonies, as though the whole world were holding its breath for the climax of the story, the defeat of evil, the triumph of good. The finale, initiated by the solo horn, confirms the life force that had been threatened by Cacci. It builds and soars, rising higher and broader and more confidently through the orchestra. Three final gestures bring the suite to an unforgettable close, majestic chords and uneven meters hurled forth by the brass. These same harmonies played again, but twice as slowly and more richly scored, and finally a heroic peroration of the brass over the sustained string tremolo. The instrumentation for this work is as follows: the piccolo, two flutes, two oboes, English horn, two clarinets, two bassoons, four horns, two trumpets, three trombones, tuba, timpani, percussion, piano, celeste, and strings. These symphony notes were written and copyrighted in 2019 by Dr. Richard E. Rota. You have been listening to Program Notes for your North Carolina Symphony, an exclusive production of the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I will be reading all of the program notes from the classical music series of the North Carolina Symphony for the remainder of the 2019 season. This program is available on demand as a podcast on the day before each concert series and will remain available for the remainder of the concert season. I'm George Douglas. Thank you for joining me today. We sincerely hope that listening to Symphony Notes will enhance your enjoyment of your North Carolina Symphony. Goodbye until next time.